to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Morning, Amy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, very well, very well. Now, we've got Stephen Kinnane online on the phone.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about a really, actually, it was a really important piece that hasn't been followed up as much as I think it should be. And it was on the ABC's background briefing, I think it was last month. And the ABC journalist actually followed up from a piece that Stephen wrote with a couple of other people in the Griffith Review. And it's all about stolen wages in Western Australia. And we obviously talk a lot about stolen wages in Queensland, and we know to the extent of the government apathy and neglect in regards to stolen wages over here, but in WA it seems almost worse. I mean, they sat on a internal government modelling for about 4 years. So we'll be speaking to him today about that, and it's very early over in WA, so I'm always really excited when we get people over in Perth to come on.
Most certainly. Stephen Kinnane, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning, Tiger. Good morning, Amy. How are you going?
Very well, very well. Steve, can you tell us your mob, your country?
I'm from Murong Country, which is up in the Kimberley, up in the northeast corner of the Kimberley, Northern Territory, WA border.
Okay, okay. Now, your circumstances have changed at home where you are with kids and stuff, so you let us know when you need to go and
I will. It should be okay. I've got a small childminder on looking on them.
All right. Okay. Now, well, you just let us know when you have to go, man, and we'll.
No worries, mate. All good.
We'll work with you.
First of all, Stephen, I was just wondering, how long have you been researching stolen wages? Because you actually have a very personal sort of reason for doing that, don't you?
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I began doing research in this area and going through these archives since 1988. Largely it was for issues of link up and putting families back together. A lot of work we did with the old Moree River Native Settlement, which was handed back to the then Wheatbelt Aboriginal Corporation. And of course, personal family history, getting access to my own grandmother's file and then working with a whole range of old people, because once we became aware of these records, we started getting our women and ourselves into the archives, and we started sort of doing our own historical research to, you know, help us understand exactly what was done. But in terms of the recent stolen wages research, that came about because we became aware through the Kimberley Community Legal Service of, I suppose, a change in the way that the government were handling this material.
When you talk about Moore River, I mean, back in 88, did you actually know the extent of how much money had actually been stolen, or was that common knowledge?
No, look, not at all. I mean, you know, we've all got our family stories and we've all got our community stories about what happened in places like Moore River. We all knew that Scuddiers or Migloos or Wadjalas knew very little about exactly what happened, and so part of the reason we started telling our histories was to make sure that these things couldn't happen again. And the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody fired us all up in those days because we felt that if people knew this story, then things would change. So in that sense, that's kind of what spurred us on to get involved. And we learned more and more through other historians like Anna Habick, Roz Kidd, Marianne Jebb, who blazed trails through those archives. And then we added our own versions, our own stories to, I suppose, the story that was in the archive.
And what actually happened at Moore River? I mean, it's considered one of the biggest government-run institutions in Western Australia. How did they withhold money from workers and particularly people like your grandmother?
Yeah, look, I was amazed to see the actuarial study that the government did themselves, which the Kimberley Community Legal Service got through Freedom of Information. to see that it was in the order of some, I think it was around $71 million that they calculated, and that was just for Moore River, and only for a short period of time, not for its entire history. So the actual amount in the millions that would have been withheld, and it's not just about stolen wages. I think the way to look at it is about withheld income. And so that income can be in the form of, from 1949, payments that people could have received for any number of things, child endowment, old age pension, maternity allowance, things like that. But basically people would work while they're in the settlement, and there was an agreement that they would get a certain amount of money or some sort of reparation for England or men working on the farm. But of course their wages were controlled by the department and put into a general trust account. And many people have testified that they never saw those wages, or if at the very least, they had no idea how that money was spent. And so a lot of this research has gone into finding out exactly what happened with that respect.
And it was very interesting when I read a little bit about your grandmother's story. Occasionally she would be given a bit of pocket money, but it was called, I guess, labelled pocket money at the time. But for the most part, if she... You get a fair idea of the extent of the control when you consider if she stepped out of line or anything like that, she could easily have her money docked again, couldn't she?
Yeah, look, that was evidenced in the personal file that we received in, I think, 1989. And basically most women who were employed as domestic servants had at least 50% of their wages controlled from early on. And then depending on how they behaved, depending on how the department perceived them, they could have up to 75% of their wage withheld. So it's clear from my own grandmother's file that when she backed up, in their view, when she left an employer who was treating her badly, or within the 12 months of her, if you like, her bonded labour under the government, then they could do any number of things. When she did it a number of times, they imprisoned her in Moore River for 16 months till she was able to get out. So what the files reveal, particularly the personal files, is the way in which the government, if you like, the machinery of government and the way in which they controlled and manipulated our population.
Yeah, it's absolutely disgraceful. And even at the governments at the time, or the protector at the time, even admitted that it was slavery. I mean, how does this get lost in our history, do you think?
Look, I think what it is also is that another thing is we tend to think of stolen wages, and it's particularly in Queensland, you know, going right through to the 1980s with what was happening at Palm Island and other places, and Ros Kidd's covered that extremely well. But in WA, a key issue that came up is that the government didn't take responsibility for anything that happened on pastoral leases, and pastoral leases were different to the individual permits that they used to employ people. So people like my grandmother who were taken away got employed under a 5 shilling permit, which was paid annually. And from that, the government basically became the broker of your wages. And so they agreed to certain conditions that should be upheld for you as a worker. So our view is they took on, if you like, a fiduciary care or a duty to that particular contract. And then they rarely ever upheld it at all. Yeah. But in the case of pastoral workers, people were employed under a general permit. So a pastoralist would take out a general permit, and they might employ anywhere up to 60 to 80 people under that permit.
Wow.
And then the government, if you like, brokered that permit, and so therefore there were certain conditions that were meant to be upheld, but they never really upheld them at all. And so in that sense, excluding pastoral workers to us seems to be a gross injustice.
What about the ages of people, Stephen? Over here we know it as indentured labour and contracts being signed by people under 15.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, under the legislation, the idea was that people could work from basically the age of 14 through to 21. And so that's why they came up with this idea of only looking at from 1958 backwards, because in 1972 that was when the Aboriginal Affairs Planning Authority Act came into being in WA. And the last vestiges of the 1905 Act were meant to have ended. But the reality, of course, is that people were working when they're on missions from a young age. They were doing work, they were working in the sewing room. Young boys were out working on stations, you know, were able to be useful. So in some ways that kind of age limit is a bit of a misnomer when you actually look at people's stories.
Mm.
Especially, it's very interesting when you look at the effect it had on families and the intersections it had with the stolen generations, because a lot of workers, obviously, because they weren't able to build a financial base because their money was stolen off them, a lot of them then had their children stolen off them. These two cases are very much linked. And when you're talking about linked up and you finding out about a lot of the sordid history through your work trying to connect families together, it seems just amazing, the connection between the stolen generations and the stolen wages scandals.
Yeah, look, it's absolutely linked, and it's really about overt control of an entire population and the way in which current governments seem to be attempting to see it as just something of legislation. It's just something that doesn't require, if you like, historical justice. It's just, you know, that's the way it was. You know, it was under legislation and therefore there's no responsibility. But even if you take that argument on face value, when you actually dig into the records, you find that they just didn't uphold their own end of the bargain, even under their own draconian and racist legislation. They were still not upholding their fiduciary duty of care to people who were under their charge. So in that sense, it's still a major area of unfinished business. And you're right in terms of, you know, what our people could have done with those wages, what people could have done if they could have been able to purchase property, what people might have left not only to their individual families, but what people might have done and what have invested in community organisations. If, you know, these millions and millions of dollars, which it now turns out, you know, was basically the value, could have been invested. We had the Corbury League over here in WA in the 1940s and 50s, and they were talking about setting up things like housing co-ops. Well, if they'd been able to access their own wages and been able to access that collective pool of money, who knows what they would have done?
Mm. Well, Dr. Roz Kidd, I mean, you've mentioned her quite a couple of times, and she's argued that exact same thing, that in a sense governments held these wages in trust, so the onus is on them to prove that the money was paid or something around those lines. And that's something the W government actually did internally, didn't they? They actually worked out this modelling with a consulting firm, which found out the true extent of the figures. But instead, what did they do, Stephen? They just sat on that report that refused to make it public.
Yeah, so what we had is the task force report responded to the Senate inquiry into stolen wages, which occurred in 2006, and the response was to set up a task force. It was under the then WA State Labor Government of Alan Carpenter. And the task force reported in 2008, so it went from 2007 to 2008, the WA task force, and they did a fairly comprehensive consultation process, and they had an Aboriginal advisory committee of some really important and serious people, and people who, you know, made sure that their views were known. And then finally, when they did deliver their report, it was sat on for some 4 years because there'd been a change of government. It changed from the Carpenter government to the Liberal government. And so for 4 years, the Aboriginal Legal Service and others were attempting to find out what was going on, were attempting to get a sense of what the government would do, and there was absolutely no answer until they decided to announce this scheme that would only run for 6 months and only provide reparation of $2,000. And there would be no real terms of reference it would be paying that compensation for. So it was extremely badly done.
And it actually found, its own modelling found a good figure would be $71 million to return, but there was a whistleblower who I mentioned at the start of the program, the ABC report, who actually said that WA government, and I think this is the Barnett government, the Treasury had actually recommended $78,000 individual payments to people who'd had their wages stolen. I mean, how does that fall from $78,000 to $2,000 and there be no outrage?
Yeah, look, I've not had access to any of that information, but I know Mr. Riley was involved as one of the committee members, and so, you know, he's given that information to background briefing. There's been no response from the government. But clearly, look, even under the recommendations of the task force report, which were more in line with payments in New South Wales and Queensland, more in the vicinity of about 10,000, it's clearly, you know, a huge drop, and it's an exercise in risk management rather than an exercise in justice.
I find it almost obscene. I'm wondering what your thoughts are. The fact that WA is our richest state and a lot of it was built off the wealth Aboriginal people hold, not only, you know, from past stolen wages, but also the theft of their land or the destruction of their land by mining companies. I mean, the fact the WA government would give such pennies when it is largely the richest state in the country seems to me even worse than other states when I put it up against other states.
Look, it was. I mean, there's no redeeming factors in this at all. The state was booming. The state wasn't investing in the state, and the feds were fumbling a whole range of issues affecting remote communities in Western Australia. They were negotiating with the Southwest mob, in particular with the Noongar claim. But apart from that, from dealing respectfully with Indigenous leaders who were attempting to make changes within our communities. So in that sense, it's part of this whole narrative that we've had probably really since 96, 97, 98, when the Howard government came in, of an increasing conservativeness that's led to, if you like, a kind of a deficit model of attempting to shift blame, so to speak, onto communities. So an argument that the Minister for Dirt, Aboriginal Affairs here in WA made when asked in Parliament by a number of people about this issue was that, well, a lot of money goes into Indigenous Affairs, and he would rattle off the figures and say, and therefore we don't see that there's any need to deal with this, you know, enough money's already going in programs and various things. But our argument would be that, you know, those aren't directed by community. They're not dealing with issues of past historical injustices. They're largely about attempting to, you know, for want of a better term, plug the gaps in service delivery that many of our communities have experienced for decades. So apart from anything else, it's largely being spent on government departments or on other service providers. It's not hitting the ground. So to say that those funds that are currently being applied or used that community don't have any, you know, involvement in choosing, are somehow compensation for past acts is, I think, an absolute furphy.
Is there any knowledge or is there any information around where a lot of that money stolen from Aboriginal people actually went? Because I know in Queensland that there's sort of unofficial accounts that it went into building roads and hospitals and infrastructure. Is it a similar case in WA where you're able to trace where that money might have gone?
Look, there are ways to trace it. There are ways you can do it partly through accessing personal files, but the only way that personal files can be accessed is by family members. And so the way to do that is to, you know, we all talk in the community. We know a number of people who've got personal files. It wouldn't be really hard at all to get a group of us together to enable, you know, those family members to be overseeing research into their own family histories, but their own cases of stolen wages, and come up with models. You could model what happened for a domestic servant. You could model what happened for a farm worker. You could model what happened for workers on pastoral leases in the Kimberley, in the Murchison, in the goldfields, and things like that. And from that, you wouldn't need
if you missed today's show.
Record. Sorry, you're there?
Yeah, sorry. I think we had a little bit of a. Yeah, sorry about that.
No worries. You wouldn't need the actual records. But you know, where they did exist, of course, you'd use them. But where they didn't exist, because some have been destroyed, you would at least have the models and you would have done some historical work to know, you know, pretty much what it would be for someone who'd worked, say, 12 years in the pastoral industry, and you could come up with a figure.
And that money that was actually taken from those workers or from the endowments, did it go into state roads or infrastructure or anything like that? Or is there any way of knowing?
Yeah, look, the way that it worked is that initially this system was set up through the missions, and the way it operated in the same way as it did for other industrial schools, which was the legislation that they are on from the 1800s through to the early 20th century. And the state government would subsidise missions, particularly Aboriginal missions. And once you'd been through a mission, in my grandmother's case, the missionaries would send you out to a family that they checked. And then the family would pay money to the mission for you, and they would bank your wages at least 50% of it on your behalf. But the difference with the missions was that once you reached the age of 21, all of those funds which were stored in that you, and the department, when they took over those bank books, But the difference being that they didn't hand money back at 21 and they kept managing that money supposedly on your behalf, but they would spend it on what they wanted, not what on you wanted.
So there's no way of knowing almost because they were just spending it any way they wanted. They weren't keeping records or anything like that?
No, they were. They kept very detailed records in some files. So in my grandmother's case, we have an exact idea of what they spent her money on. So they spent it on things such as when she was imprisoned in Moorooba, they paid the police woman her money to escort her to Moorooba. Sorry, escort's kind of a nice way to put it. That's the way they refer to it in the file. If she wanted to see a doctor, she would be required to come into the state doctor who was here in Perth. If she was working out in Quiriding, which is a fair way out from the city, she would have to purchase a railway permit and she would have to purchase a railway ticket. She may even have to have an escort. Being Aboriginal, she'd have to stay at the East Perth Girls Home here in the city where they charged you £1 per week for the privilege of staying there and cleaning and looking up after yourself while going to visit the state doctor who charged much more than the local doctor in the little town where you might be working. So for all of that, they would use your wages, your trust account, to pay for things that like medical care, health care, transport, but things that even the state was supposed to pay for as a part of its own legislation.
Yeah.
And so we find that what they were tending to do was not just spend it on consolidated revenue, although they might have, we're not sure. But we can certainly see in the personal files that they used it to, if you like, uphold the system of control and manipulation of your liberty.
And I would assume that at the time your grandmother had no knowledge that that care or the medical care was being paid for by herself from her stolen money, in a way.
No, look, I don't think so. But speaking to old girls who were around at the time, or women, women would do things like, you know, if everyone found themselves in the city at the East Perth Girls Home, they would all attempt to go to the department to get money out. And they'd know that, you know, maybe half of them would get knocked back. And so for those half that didn't get knocked back, they'd then share whatever wages they had with other people and people would pay them back when then they got a chance to get access to their money. So people knew they had money there.
Yeah.
People would be doing everything they could to get access to that money. But in terms of knowing exactly how much, knowing what it was being spent on, you know, being able to see your file and see, you know, what was being done, there was just no sense from the government that people had a right to see that or to understand that information.
And that $2,000 offer, I mean, you mentioned before that there was a time limit offer, but it's not really that, but a time limit to actually apply for it. I know a lot of the problems with it were people unable to actually put forth those records. How did people get around that? Because I know a lot of people were actually knocked back even for just $2,000, which seems just such an offensive offer.
Yeah, look, in the end, 700 people who were knocked back happened to be people who were all working on pastoral leases. And so these are people who are employed under permits provided by the state to work under these group permits. Their wages were then controlled by the station manager with permission of the state, then including also from 1949 things like maternity allowances, old age pension and various other things. And then the state basically said, well, no, we weren't responsible for that. That was the station that was responsible, so we're not going to take into account anyone who was working on a pastoral lease. So that's still an that's something that the ALS is looking into.
Right.
But you're right. The government basically set up their own very narrow parameters about what did constitute their involvement in your life, and they called these things government native welfare settlements. So they created a new term for any of these places that they subsidised, where people were either incarcerated or held or forced to work for a period of time. And then they came up with just a magic figure of $2,000 and said, for no matter how long you're in one of these institutions, might have been 3 years, might have been 17 years, you'd get a payment of $2,000.
And they never actually explained what a native welfare settlement actually was, or what, you know, which settlements actually fell under that definition, did they? So, I mean, people who are claiming wouldn't even know if they were claiming under the right thing.
No, they didn't. That was basically found out by the Kimberley Community Legal Service, in particular Judy Harrison, working for claimants and putting in freedom of information requests to access that information. The government didn't provide any information about how the scheme would be assessed, about how individuals would be assessed. And so for that 6 months, and then they allowed another three-month window, so that for that period of 9 months, basically the community were getting as many applications in as possible and seeing it as a way to tell stories, as a way to ensure that people's experiences were recorded. But even so, the government's response was basically to withhold information, operate from their own separate assessment criteria, and get it over with as quickly as possible with as little expenditure as possible. And I think in the end they paid out something like $2.5 million.
Wow. Nothing. Stephen, the Queensland experience was that there was quite a large proportion of our mob that didn't know anything about, didn't get the information, so they were just sort of, they missed out. But the criteria for payment, I mean, for example, the claimants must can't be deceased claimants.
That's right.
One of the issues, and that's a bit of an issue over here. Our mob, that's just, you know, not right. The whole family suffered, generation suffered since deceased member. The family should be able to make claims on behalf of deceased members.
Yeah, and that's an argument here in Western Australia that the legal service is taking up as well.
What are the other criteria for the payment?
Well, basically the criteria for the payment seemed to be that you were indentured in one of these government native welfare settlements, and that's pretty much it. Even though the task force report itself recommended a community reparations fund, beyond the individual payments, it recommended training for Aboriginal archivists. It recommended setting up a much better system whereby information could be returned to the community, so similar to Queensland's Family History Unit, which is, you know, an amazing resource that operates over there. I think Kathy Franklin is the person who runs it. Mm. And, you know, we don't have anything like that at all here in Western Australia. So those things would have gone a long way to, you know, showing that the current government were serious about this issue of, if you like, historical justice for our communities, but they didn't act at all. So this all remains very much unfinished business.
When you talk about, I mean, it's really sad that both Labor and Liberal are really complicit in this. Do you share the view that Labor sat on that report because of that reason, that people, potential claimants, would probably most likely pass away, or, you know, there'd be less claimants once they actually put something in place?
Yeah, I don't know that Labor did. Literally, the then Premier ordered a snap election thinking that he might win it, but he lost it. So by the time the task force report was delivered, it was essentially delivered and not really Labor's responsibility anymore. But in terms of that view that maybe that they were waiting for 4 years, that was the Liberal government who sat on it for 4 years. I don't know. I don't have a clear idea, but it does. You do wonder why someone would wait 4 years to, you know, come up with a scheme when they had a very detailed process. I don't know how much they invested in the actual task force, but they had something like 68 or more community consultations. They had hundreds of community members provide information to the task force. The report itself was fairly comprehensive. And, you know, I had a few issues with some of its findings around, you know, stating that there's not enough information to go back to the files in a way that New South Wales does. But overall, it wasn't a bad. It didn't have bad recommendations. But yeah, they definitely sat on it for 4 years, and we lost people in that time. So they definitely benefited, regardless of what their actual intentions were. And I couldn't say they definitely benefited from sitting on it for 4 years.
Mm, of course. Yep.
In Queensland, we had this situation where obviously there was a $4,000 take it or leave it payment, $55.6 million. Reparations scheme. Yep. And a lot of people, because it was just such a low offer and was seen as just so offensive, a lot of people didn't take it. Was that a similar case in WA, that where people were so offended, or was it just a case of we're never going to get anything better, so we might as well just apply for this?
Look, I think The difference in WA that it wasn't take it or leave it, as in it didn't. It doesn't mean that people don't have other avenues to bring a case against the state or to maybe even be involved in future schemes down the track. And I believe Labor are looking at, if they do get elected, they're looking at revisiting this and revisiting the whole issue, doing an inquiry and coming up with a better scheme. But I think that the way it was done was actually that people, it was done so quickly, it was announced so quickly, people responded as quickly as they could. And then a couple of claimants that I'm aware of just found that there was a $2,000 payment in their account. They didn't get a letter until after the payment had occurred in some cases. And then when the letter arrived, it didn't really explain to any great degree what the payment was for. It just said, it didn't actually say sorry. It just said, you've been assessed and we found that you have a claim and therefore you're now being paid. So in some people's cases, they just found $2,000 in their account. And it was around the time when there were a number of other payments coming back from government around, electricity benefit schemes and various things. So for some people, it was incredibly confusing exactly where this money had come from.
In Queensland, claimants were required to sign an indemnity.
Yeah, no, they weren't in WA, which is, I suppose, one good thing. But, that's outrageous, particularly that kind of take-it-or-leave-it approach. I mean, that would place incredible pressure on people and be seen, I'm sure, as, another slap in the face.
I think it's really interesting how you talked about, getting that $2,000 payment and not even knowing what it's for. I mean, what does that do for people's sense of healing? I mean, part of reparations, it's not just the money value. It's about actually being able to move on and to heal. I mean, there's so many other parts of reparations than just money. I mean, how does that psychologically affect families, just having governments deal with you in that way?
Yeah, look, it's not surprising, sadly. It's extremely unfortunate. It flies in the face of every kind of statement, every kind of, policy about building new and just relationships and all those sorts of things. So it does smack of a certain kind of disingenuousness on the part of government. So I just, like many people, I don't understand if you're actually serious about engaging with the community, if you're serious about taking on a lot of the kind of really positive initiatives that Aboriginal leaders in Western Australia are putting forward from a whole range of different communities, Fitzroy Crossing, Halls Creek, activities taking place with PBCs on the ground. It seems to work completely against any positive relationship building, and it does certainly have an impact. It wears people down, and it means that it makes people extremely untrustworthy when government then make positive statements in the future.
We might take a break for a song, Stephen. Give you a chance to just check on your little ones.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a minute. Our guest, Stephen Kinnane, talking to us about stolen wages in WA. And it's not a pretty picture either. Over there. Dale Huddleston, Walkabout. Now, our guest today is Stephen Kinnane, and he's talking to us about stolen wages over in WA. Stephen, where are things at now? There's just some talk about a class action?
Yes. Aboriginal Legal Service are looking into that at the moment.
Is that the only avenue available, do you think, or are there other avenues?
Look, it's not the only avenue available. The state government could reconsider evidence that's been coming out. Or if there is a change of government, the incoming Labor government, if that occurs, has stated, in particular, Ben Wyatt has been doing a bit of work in this regard, Deputy Leader for Labor, and a really important Aboriginal leader here in WA has been talking about revisiting the entire scheme. So those are two avenues other than class action that could occur.
And it'd be a lot nicer for governments to step up to the plate rather than having to drag it through the courts again, wouldn't it?
Look, it's one of those classic missed opportunities, as in it was actually they seemed to take the approach of being under siege and seeking to minimise any engagement with the community, when really it was an opportunity to deal with a historical injustice in a way that included recommendations about scholarship programs, traineeships, education, oral history programs, creating better access to records. There are just so many things that can come from dealing with this issue appropriately that are nothing but positive for the community and for government, but they seem to be shy of approaching this issue with that kind of genuineness.
We talked a little bit about the intersecting issues and what, you know, stealing this money and pensions and everything like that actually did to communities. I mean, how would you see it more broadly across Aboriginal WA when you look at things like closing communities, the rising incarceration crisis? I mean, can we link a lot of this, these current day poverty and disadvantage problems back to those original stealing of money?
I wouldn't say that back to only the stealing of money, because, of course, that was a part of an overt system of control. It went down to, you know, creating an incredibly poor educational outcome across the board for the community. It was down to not being able to access decent health services. It was down to an almost expectation that being treated as a second-class citizen was somehow normal. And those sorts of things create a social trauma, a communal social trauma, that really is at the heart of a lot of the problems that we've seen besieging our communities around substance abuse, around domestic violence and other issues where that does occur for, you know, a core group of people. And often, as we know, within our communities, often that's kind of passed down through families. It's not always the case, and it's not that, you know, a particular family or any family should be singled out, but often those kinds of issues of social trauma are handed down, and they do have their genesis in these past treatments.
I wonder, current day policies, I mean, obviously you can't completely compare them to the past Protection Acts, but when I look at things like what government are trying to do in, one, moving off people off communities, but also there's trials for example, income management and healthy welfare cards and really these other systems of protecting money, but even more sort of complex and more, you know, smarter ways of protecting Aboriginal people's money. I mean, that form of control just seems really controversial when you consider the traumatic effect these sort of protections had on Aboriginal people in the past. I mean, the way governments are currently going in relation to their policies and Aboriginal people supposedly taking more responsibility and everything like that, it seems to be returning to those days of the past. I was wondering what your thoughts are regarding that.
Look, if you look at any regional community, any regional Aboriginal governance structures, community-based organisations, invariably you'll find that we've got schemes that have been in place. I mean, even the schemes that led to the creation of Aboriginal organisations across Western Australia, you know, they were community-owned, community-initiated, and they had an impact and they had success. And I'm thinking back to the 1970s in particular when, you know, there was practically no government involvement, very little government involvement other than the beginning of, if you like, people beginning to access welfare, particularly in Western Australia and the Kimberley. So, look, the solutions are always in the community, and some of those solutions may well be not draconian by any means, but may well be tough, as in it may be about, you know, circle sentencing. It might be about elders' councils making some pretty tough decisions about what young people are expected to do. It may even be about, you know, who gets to take care of kids of community members who have fallen on hard times and may even have issues of substance abuse besieging their house. But invariably, they're not about disconnection. They're not about punishment. They're generally about trying to work with people and deal with the issues that have become ingrained in their lives. And so in that sense, these schemes that are largely punitive do seem to go completely against the successes that we can point to. Yeah. That our own community organisations have initiated, often on the smell of an oily rag, often on pilot programs, and often with great success. But invariably, you know, the goalposts get shifted, the programs end, a new dogma kind of gets put forward, the new mantra, and we just have to deal with it.
And personally, just before we let you go, I'm just wondering what you would like to see done personally. I mean, you have such a personal stake in the stolen wages scandal in WA. What would you like to see happen to help your family move on?
Well, I think with our own family, my grandmother actually became aware of the way in which her wages were being controlled, and she kind of came up with a few schemes to get her money back, to the point where when she actually married my grandfather, who was a gutier, and was considered to be no longer under the department, although she still was because they were watched by the police and he was threatened with all kinds of arrests and periods of imprisonment because he was having other Aboriginal community members come and visit his house, as they saw it. Nana actually ended up with a debt. She had to pay, her and my grandfather paid money back to the department that they see that she owed them, because she came up with all these elaborate schemes to borrow money from employers, and then employers would not get paid back, and then they hit up the department for the money, who would pay and then charge my grandmother. So, look, I think in our case, our grandmother raised us all with a very healthy sense that you keep government completely out of your lives because basically they're hopeless and they don't really do anything of value for community. But for the wider community, what I'd like to see is that there's a bigger picture approach taken, that it's seen on a community scale, that individuals get to have a really clear understanding of what happened in a general way for pastoral workers, for domestic servants, for farm labourers in the southwest. You know, our labourers underpin this wealth, the wealth of this state. And what I'd like to see is that that underpinning is recognised, respected and appropriately recompensed in a way that engages the community. The community may choose to take appropriate individual family payments for a clear picture of exactly what happened to the kind of work that their grandparents or parents or aunties or uncles did. Or people may choose to take a collective invested in something for the benefit of future generations around education, scholarships, training, history programs. I think it'd be a mix of the two, and that's what I'd like to see. And I think that would be a win for all Western Australians if that approach could be taken.
So effectively, you just want to see Aboriginal people have control over their future, which is exactly what didn't happen when we talk about stolen wages. You want blackfellas to be able to decide what happens next.
Look, it's really simple. When we get to decide, when we get to make those decisions, we generally come up with a much fairer and effective way of doing things. And I just don't see why that is a problem for the government.
I don't understand it either, I don't think. But no governments around the country have actually cottoned onto that fact yet, which is the really sad thing, I think. They haven't understood that the solutions are within Aboriginal communities.
Well, they know we'll do a better job. Stephen,
yes.
We're about out of time, mate. Really appreciate you joining us at an early time of the day for you and with your little ones as well to take care of. So, mate, thank you very much, mate. Thank you. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me on, and great to hear your voice again. I haven't heard your voice since 1988, as in, except on the radio, of course. I bumped into you. I was at the 10 Embassy in Sydney for about a month leading up to the Andrew Bicentenary, and also down around La Perouse. And you were an important element of that particular time, and it's been wonderful to be able to talk to you again.
Oh, good on you, mate. Thank you, and it's good to catch up. You have a good one. Keep up the great work.
You too. And thanks, Sammy. See you later.
Thanks for that.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.